suspension and placing and extending and then two more imposing. So aren't you kind of mixing your verbs?
We talked about that.
Oh. I'm going to turn this over to Jack to see if we can get some better grammatical configurations on that and to work with some additional drafting and be in touch with Judge Joseph and people of that order and see what we can work out with respect to the language issues. Okay, Jack?
Sure.
Anything further? Thank you, Brad. We have people who wish to comment on the amendments. Come on up, Mr. Fedenke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm David Fedenke, Associate Director, ACLU of Oregon. Were the amendments to come before you and without the underlying provisions of House Bill 2470, we would not have much of a problem with them. However, the two in conjunction, we believe, could cause real problems. As Bob Homan testified before you when this bill was up for a public hearing, we believe that House Bill 2470 would have the result of imposing unconstitutional conditions on people subject to probation. Layering these amendments on top of that may make it very difficult for defendants to challenge those unconstitutional conditions on appeal. Those conditions may not necessarily be considered cruel and unusual. They may be disproportionate. They may violate some other provision of the Constitution. I don't know what the best way is to deal with this. We do have problems with the underlying proposal. Perhaps one alternative.
Madam Chair,
Senator Schumer,
could you give us an example of what this might be? I think I'd have get a hold of it better.
It's very common currently for defendants subjected to probation to be required to submit to searches and seizures at any time by an officer of the Parole and Probation Department, or limitations on their associations, limitations on their travel. Some of those conditions could not even be imposed were the defendant imprisoned, particularly the searches and seizures at any time, day or night. Even prisoners, inmates in the state penitentiary, retain some privacy protections under the search and seizure protections of the state and federal constitutions. Those conditions, if they are imposed without the consent of the defendant, may in fact be unconstitutional. And we want to ensure that those conditions can be challenged if they are imposed without the consent of the defendant, that those conditions could be challenged on appeal rather than waiting.
Then I think you ought to talk about the what you're trying to get at here, which is the conditions and the challenge of the conditions versus saying I don't want to go on probation and I want to go to the joints. I think there are two. I would be interested in your working along the lines of trying to make those separable if you can, because I do think we've had additional contacts from the Corrections Division that they are getting a lot more people, even the last few months, under that provision, and that they're feeling that some of the folks that they're getting, you know, some major, is due to people.
Madam Chair, we are very sensitive to that current problem, and I would suggest that if you're going to move forward with House Bill 2470 and with these amendments, that you consider changing the language that comes up throughout the amendments is unconstitutionally cruel and unusual to merely say is unconstitutional. We believe that would clearly provide that those types of conditions could be subject to review on appeal, and believe that those situations would not occur very often, but it is important to deal with them on appeal.
Senator Springer.
Well, let me think of, you know, there's been a lot of focus, quote, on creative sentencing and creative conditions of probation, because we recognize, you know, locking people up, we can't afford to do it, and it's not always the answer. We had real cause celeb out of Multnomah County with Judge Baker with requiring an individual to post on his residence, I guess, that he had been convicted or pled to a sex offense. I can envision, and I don't know if that was upheld on appeal. Do you know the answer to that?
The court didn't reach the merits on that.
It didn't reach the merits, so presumably that hasn't been tested fully. I guess a court could tell a person if they passed a bad check, if you get a checking account in the future, you got to put a warning on your checks that you've been convicted of passing bad checks, or forbid you from having a checking account. Or if you've done fraudulent credit cards, you couldn't have a credit card. Or if you committed welfare fraud, you could never apply for public assistance. I guess the list is endless. Is that part of your concern?
Indeed, Madam Chair, Senator Springer, that is part of our concern. And there's sort of a catch-22 here, we believe. If defendants have the right to refuse probation, then it could be argued that when they consent to probation, they consent to such conditions that otherwise would be unconstitutional. If, on the other hand, they have no right to withhold consent, then the court may lose its ability to impose those kinds of creative sentencing options. And we believe that if that consent is taken away, courts will impose such unconstitutional conditions, and that it's very important those conditions be reviewable at the earliest possible time.
Madam Chair?
Senator Grinsky.
We're talking now about the United States Constitution, so are there other...
And the state constitution, Senator Grinsky.
You're primarily concerned with the federal constitution, aren't you?
In fact, I think we're primarily concerned with the state constitution.
Okay, which aspect of that?
The Bill of Rights, Article 1. Everything from freedom of expression to freedom from unreasonable searches or seizures to protection against disproportionate punishment.
Well, all that's included in the federal constitution, too. Now, there must be
Not all of it, Senator Grinsky.
Okay, which exactly, then? That's what I'm trying to find out.
I don't have the Bill of Rights in front of me, but there are a number of provisions in Article 1 which do not have analogous provisions in the federal constitution.
I assume there are other states where someone convicted of a crime is not allowed to select whether they'll go on probation or serve their sentence.
I don't know the answer to that question, Senator.
So we'll get that answer for you.
Well, the reason I'm asking is, rather than conjecture on whether this would fly or wouldn't fly, it'd be nice to know if some other states have done this. I'm sure some have. And whether or not it has been upheld, at least under the federal constitution. Their state constitution, of course, won't be the same, but I think that that would be of some assistance to us.
We'll get the sponsor of the bill to track some of that down and to work through both the grammar and explore the possibilities of giving them the option to say, you can't refuse probation, you could appeal the conditions, but you can't decide just arbitrarily to go in, and then we'll see how strict your appeal on the conditions can be, whether people want to. Whether we're creating a frivolous challenge regularly on the conditions, I don't want to set that up either, but right. We'll see if there can be some balance or at least to take a look at that.
Thank you.
Any other comments on House Bill 2470 before I turn it over to Jack, and who will be in touch with interested parties to try to see if we can come to some resolution about how to deal with this matter? Don't see any arms waving out there, so we'll close the work session on House Bill 2470. I would like to go ahead and take things up in this order. We'll move to House Bill 2282, back to that, and then after we finish with 2282, we'll take up 2668. I know there are people who come from a ways to get into 2268, but I do want to take up 2282, back to 2282. Pete Shepard.
Lights, adding material.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice in the Criminal Justice Division. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2282 and also to convey to you the Attorney General's strong support for this measure. He was unable to be here today because he had a commitment in Portland, but he's been intimately involved in the evolution of this measure and has submitted some written testimony for your consideration today.
Madam Chair, has the governor been consulted on this?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, yes, he has. It's my understanding that Ms. Streisinger will be here today to state his position in support of this.
Senator, Ms. Streisinger called me this morning and specifically asked me to put on the record that the governor strongly supports this bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think perhaps I can best serve the committee today by reviewing the major policy issues, and the best way to do that in this area is to review with you the procedures that are followed in House Bill 2282 to accomplish a forfeiture, because the policy choices that have been made in the course of bringing the proposal to this point are really embedded in those procedural measures. And I have a little chart that might help the committee follow along.
There are really four major policy issues, four categories of policy issues that were addressed and were ultimately each considered in turn by the House Committee and sent on to you in the form of a House Bill 2282. Broadly, they might be divided into questions about the scope of forfeiture, questions about procedure, how to accomplish a forfeiture, questions about how one protects innocent owners in the course of developing a strong forfeiture proposal, and finally questions like those raised by Senator Springer already regarding the distribution of the fruits of the forfeiture process. What I want to do is briefly review within each of those categories the major choices as they're represented in 2282 at this time. First question with respect to the scope of a forfeiture proposal is the question of whether the state will mandate forfeiture coverage border to border, or whether, as was proposed at one point during the interim committee discussion, the state will simply give local jurisdictions the authority to adopt their own local forfeiture ordinances. This committee, I'm sure, has some familiarity with the fact that up until recently, January, we believed that local jurisdictions had authority under the laws that presently exist to adopt their own local forfeiture ordinances. In two cases decided in January, the Court of Appeals told us that that wasn't the case, and then again, they reaffirmed that just recently in a case that came out of Multnomah County. So we know that the answer under existing law, at least according to the Court of Appeals at this point, is that local jurisdictions do not have authority to adopt their own forfeiture ordinances. The choice made in House Bill 2282 is for forfeiture authority border to border. One of the reasons that that choice was made was the principle, and in fact the demonstrated fact, that jurisdictions that have forfeiture ordinances were successful in moving criminal conduct out of their jurisdictions and into adjacent jurisdictions which did not have forfeiture authority. I had that experience as a deputy district attorney here in Marion County when the city of Salem adopted its forfeiture ordinance. We suddenly found that our cases came more often from outside the city limits of Salem in the unincorporated areas of Marion County because there was at that time no county forfeiture ordinance. So the choice in 2282 is border-to-border coverage for forfeiture. There's a second kind of scope question, and that is what kind of conduct will trigger the potential for a forfeiture? And in the initial draft of House Bill 2282, all vice crimes, gambling, prostitution, and drugs would serve as the basis for potential forfeiture. One of the choices that the House Committee made on this issue was that they selected instead to go only with forfeiture for drug-related offenses. And so the bill before you today is narrowly targeted to drugs. There is a way in which forfeiture and
can be achieved in other kinds of cases. And how, what it does, what the bill does, is it provides that local jurisdictions may enact their own forfeiture enactment so long as they follow the procedures in House Bill 2282. And their own enactment may, as Representative Bauman told you earlier, include forfeiture for crimes not now enumerated in House Bill 2282. So that Multnomah County, for example, could choose, if they wish, to adopt an ordinance that allowed forfeiture in gambling cases. The procedure that would be followed for forfeiture would be that specified in 2282.
Yes, I'm it.
Mr. Spring.
Yeah, we've had bills last session before, I think, that state to this point for prostitution, for example. So if City of Portland, for example, decided to enact this procedure for the Johns, they could do that under the local option?
Right, Chair. Senator Springer, that's correct. The Multnomah County could choose to do that as any other county could choose.
Is that county or city?
City or county.
City or county, thank you.
Either. Third kind of scope question is, once you have a forfeiture declared or the basis for a forfeiture, what is it that's going to be subjected to forfeiture? How much of the person's property can be subjected to forfeiture once the basic predicates, whatever they may be, for forfeiture are established? And here the question is put to a point by a recent case from the Ninth Circuit in which a gentleman was growing marijuana in a small corner of a 40-acre parcel of property. And the question that was presented to the court was, under the federal law on which much of this proposal was modeled, can he lose his whole 40-acre farm because he has a small portion of it devoted to the purpose of cultivating marijuana? And the answer in the Ninth Circuit is yes, he can. That the otherwise, the principle of proportionality that might attach under the Eighth Amendment, the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the United States Constitution, does not apply in the area of civil forfeiture. And so the proposal that's before you today does not include a proportionality requirement. If one has a very small quantity of cocaine in one's car, whether you're a buyer or a seller, your car may be subjected to forfeiture.
Question. I remember some testimony yesterday that if your civil penalty is at too high a level, it becomes in effect a criminal penalty. And wouldn't almost the same issues about proportionality put you out of the civil into the criminal and then into the Eighth Amendment?
Senator Shoemaker, that's an excellent question, very timely one. The United States Supreme Court decided a case last week. I believe the name is Harper on the case. I've read the case carefully now, and I believe it's distinguishable from the circumstance presented by a civil forfeiture. The first thing is that in that case, the court was evaluating something that Congress had identified as a penalty. And the civil forfeiture scheme that's before you today is not merely a penalty. It certainly includes some punitive quality. But this bill has purposes well beyond simple punitive interest. And it's useful here to contrast it with an Oregon case, Brown versus Multnomah County District Court, in which the issue was whether the legislature's determination that driving under the influence would be, quote, decriminalized was complete, whether the legislature had completely decriminalized that bill. And the issue was whether it was a civil or criminal procedure, because Mr. Brown wanted to have a court-appointed attorney, which he was entitled to if it was a criminal case. There are really several distinctions there, Senator, between the scheme that's before you and the analysis that was presented in Brown. The first thing is that in Brown, the Oregon Supreme Court said that to be a penal sanction, the sole purpose must be to penalize some conduct. The sole purpose in Brown was to make it tougher on drunk drivers. That's different than here because we have multiple purposes. The second thing is, in Brown, they pointed out that one question about whether a sanction was penal or civil is whether the conduct involved is being conducted for profit or rather for some other motive. And in Brown, of course, we had a drunk driver who was not doing that for profit. In this case, we have an activity that's conducted for profit. And so we're distinguished on a second ground.
distinguished from Brown, but does that get you away from the issue?
Yes, I think it does, Senator. The issue presented in Brown was the same analysis was followed in Brown as in the United States Supreme Court opinion, which was decided last week. The third distinction is that in this case, we have the purpose here of assuring uniform procedure from county to county so that claimants may be assured wherever their property is subjected to forfeiture, they enjoy the same kinds of protections that they do in any other part of the state. And again, that was a purpose that was not present in Brown.
How about the particular forfeiture that is ordered in a particular case? I haven't read the bill, but I assume that's left to the court. Or do you have guidelines here?
Senator Shoemaker, the bill does not, as I say, contain guidelines as to the severity of the forfeiture. Once the finding of the predicate conduct is made, then there's no inquiry as to whether the forfeiture is proportionate to that, to the severity of the conduct. There is one exception to that in the bill, and that has to do with the area of possession of less than an ounce of marijuana. As presently drafted,
Mr. Shepard, you started to talk about distinguishing the Harper case. I'm not sure that the committee members are clear on what exactly the holding was. Could you just...
Mr. Morris, in the Harper case, the issue presented was that a gentleman had committed 65 acts of Medicare fraud, and the federal statute provided a $2,000 penalty per act, and it was described in the federal statute as a civil penalty. And the federal district court had declined to impose a $130,000 penalty on those facts. And the analysis proceeded of that sanction and the court's refusal to impose that. And the United States Supreme Court decided that the district judge was correct, that on those facts, and given the analysis in that case, which several of the concurring opinions emphasized was limited to the facts of those in that case, that indeed it was a criminal sanction, and the cruel and unusual punishment section of the United States Constitution protected the defendant in that case from suffering the full $130,000 sanction.
Well, it did protect it.
The cruel and unusual punishment clause of the United States Constitution.
So they held then that really had gone over the line and was a criminal.
On those facts, yes. Yeah.
So ours is vulnerable then to unconstitutional as applied.
There is, and certainly will be, an argument about whether this bill is constitutional or not. What my testimony is, I believe we can distinguish that case and Brown versus Multnomah County successfully.
I'm not sure that that gets you all the way there, though.
It's a start, Senator.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me refer now to some of the basic procedural issues that are presented by this bill. The first is that this is a civil proceeding. It's civil in terms of its burden of proof. It's civil in terms of its intent. It's civil in terms of its purpose. And further, it's a unique kind of civil proceeding in that it's a civil proceeding not against the person, but rather against the offending property. The basic premise of forfeiture law is that the property itself has offended against the public's interest, and therefore is guilty, and therefore is subject to forfeiture to the state. And this bill follows the federal statute, which is 21 U.S.C. Section 881, in the premise that these are actions against the property. And so these cases are entitled State of Oregon versus 1973 Thunderbirds, whatever it is. Second kind of procedural issue is, what is the seizure authority that the police officers have? What are the circumstances that will allow a police officer to grab a piece of property that may be subject to forfeiture under the bill? There are two ways in which a seizure may be commenced under the bill. The first way is with a court order after an affidavit. And that is modeled after the statutes which lay out the requirements for search warrant affidavits. And indeed, the bill provides that the authority to seize property may be endorsed on a criminal search warrant as well as in a separate order if you choose to do so. The standard for any seizure under the bill is probable cause. The government must have probable cause to believe that the property is subject to forfeiture. Again, the same kind of standard that the government would require to execute a criminal search warrant for to execute a criminal search of other kinds. The alternative mechanism for seizure of property under the bill is seizure without order if you have probable cause to believe that the property is subject to forfeiture. Let me give you an example of a case that came up last week that we're still investigating, so I can't give you all the details on it, but the gist of it is that the police executed a criminal search warrant. They found evidence of a bank account containing $107,000 in cash, and they believed that they had probable cause that $107,000 was the result of the marijuana grow operation that they had located when they executed the criminal search warrant. Because we don't have adequate forfeiture authority in Oregon at the moment, the best way to grab that property right now is to get a criminal search warrant to seize the fruits of criminal conduct. All that allows is the seizure of the fruits. It doesn't allow the forfeiture, but at least it's a way to tie the bank account up. Well, it took several hours to get that, and in the interim, the gentleman bailed out and removed his $107,000 from the bank. Under House Bill 2282, the police officers would have had authority when they located those bank records to go to the bank and say, we have probable cause to believe that this specified account is the product of growing marijuana. And so we are asking under authority of 2282 that you write us a cashier's check for the amount of that account. Now the bill has
Mr. Shepard, let me interrupt you. There was another bill before us that would permit almost instantaneous search and seizure warrants to be issued through telephone to judges that are given that particular authority. And it was designed to meet the kind of problem that you mentioned. If that bill were to become law, would you be comfortable with that as the authority to make such a seizure rather than simply allowing the officer to make a statement that he believed he had probable cause?
Senator Shoemaker, no, that would not be adequate.
Why?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. The first reason is that I've had some experience with those cell phone search warrants, and in fact, they are not instantaneous. We are talking about, in the best of circumstances, an hour. And even an hour is enough for a gentleman who has incentive to take care of the property. More importantly, I envision these seizures, and in fact, the way seizures are presently being made for forfeiture under federal authority, being made at the point of arrest as well as pursuant to search warrants. So we have the case of a police officer who makes a traffic stop on a vehicle, obtains consent to search the car, and locates in the trunk controlled substances. Under the bill, the car is subject to forfeiture. The police officer should have authority at that point to seize that automobile without going to court and obtaining a separate order. Now, the House Committee had improved our bill, and they did so by adding a requirement that if the police officer makes a seizure without a court order, that the person from whom the property has been seized has an absolute right to a hearing within 15 days as on the question of whether the police officer had probable cause to make that seizure. So if the seizure takes place without prior judicial review, then a person has a right to a speedy hearing as to whether the police officer made a justified seizure or not. Senator, I think there are some great incentives in the bill for seizures to be made with orders. And one of those incentives is that the bill provides immunity to police officers who act pursuant to an order. But it does not extend that immunity to a police officer who acts on probable cause alone. So I think there will be a great incentive for people to make seizures pursuant to orders, but I would encourage the committee not to remove that provision from the bill. The process then continues. If the property is real property or it is subject to a security interest, the only way the property can be subjected to forfeiture is pursuant to a judicial forfeiture. And that is commenced, of course, with the filing of a complaint in court, and it's a complaint in rem, as I mentioned. If the property is not real property and is not subject to a security interest, then the property may be subjected to forfeiture according to an administrative procedure. And that's a procedure that's initiated by the police agency itself. It requires the police agency to publish notice of its intent to subject the property to forfeiture. and it requires it to do so in a newspaper of general circulation in the jurisdiction in which the seizure took place. If there is no claim filed with respect to that property, and in the federal system, about 89% of the cash seizures are not contested. They proceed directly then through the administrative forfeiture process to an order of forfeiture in the federal system. In our system, in 2282, the police officer will have to go to court in order to obtain a judgment of forfeiture if no claim is filed. But the officer does that by executing an affidavit that says that there is my probable cause for why this is subject to forfeiture. And I published notice, and here's the evidence that I did so. And no claimant came forward, and here's the evidence that no claimant came forward. Therefore, Your Honor, I ask that you enter a judgment of forfeiture as to this property, at which point the court would enter the judgment of forfeiture and the process would be completed. Alternatively, if a claim is filed with respect to property, a person comes forward and says, have my property, I want it back, it's not subject to forfeiture, then the process must be commenced as a judicial proceeding, just as though it was real property or was subject to security interest.
Mr. Shepard, if in your secured interest case, someone holding a security interest for whatever reason doesn't step forward,